Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and now in Dallas on 1360 AM Rational Radio. Today I'm talking to you from the farm in Summertown, Tennessee. The farm is a collective that's been going on for 38 years, started by some hippies back in 1971, and that's what they call themselves, hippies. So now I'm just checking out a communal life and a collective life, and it's pretty cool. I'm just going to be here for a couple days before I move on down to Florida. I have two wonderful guests today. I can't even believe I'm so honored. My first guest is going to be Governor Jesse Ventura. He's a former professional wrestling star and an independent governor of Minnesota. You know, everybody knows who Jesse Ventura is, so I don't have to talk too much about him. And my second guest will be writer, activist Derek Jensen. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, so stay tuned. We'll be right back with our interview with Governor Ventura.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. As I promised before the break, I'm very honored to have my first guest with us today, Governor Jesse Ventura. Governor Ventura, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Hi, it's nice to be here, Cindy. How are you today?
Well, I'm okay. I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. Well, actually, I'm outside of Nashville, Tennessee at a place called The Farm. Are you in Baja today?
No, I'm up in Minnesota. I live in the Baja during the winter time, but
generally get
home May and June, and then I won't depart again until about November.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Minnesota. I've only, unfortunately, been there in January.
Well, that's the time for the young people of Minnesota that can stand the winters now. I'm a little older now, so I bail out now and leave it to the young people.
Right. Well, before I get into the interview, I just want to say that my son Casey, who was killed in Iraq, was a huge WWF or WWE fan, and it's such an honor to talk to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and my condolences on Casey's death.
Oh,
it was a death that shouldn't have happened. There shouldn't have been a war there, and bear in mind, though, always remember this, your son had more courage than our president and vice president did.
Well, put together, for sure. But also, you know, he was a big fan of your political career, too, and we were watching it very closely from California because of, you know, the previous, connection to wrestling. But, you know, I ran against Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco as an independent or declined a state, and I know you ran for governor of Minnesota on a third-party ticket, and, of course, you won, so, you know, you did very well. Do you think there's much hope for third parties or independents in the federal government?
Well, it depends how we progress, and it, of course, needs to start at the grassroots level. And I see some signs of it turning that way. Minneapolis is now going to do this new type of voting where you pick your first and second choice so that the winner has to achieve the 50% level. And I know the two parties really oppose that because that in itself can be the rise of a third party, because I was able to win because I was a centrist. I was in the common sense middle. I wasn't on the far left, and I wasn't on the far right. And the two parties, of course, have to appeal to those extreme interests when they get their nomination, and then when they attempt to get back in the middle, that's who they fight to get to see who gets elected. Well, in my case, I had the middle occupied, and they were not able to get back in, and that's how I was able to win. So it's called runoff ballots. Runoff balloting is what they call it, where you do your first and second choice.
Right.
And then if your candidate finishes third, then they take all those votes and apply them to their second choice,
right,
which I think that could really lead to the rise of a third party. Now, it'll start at the grassroots level, like at the city level, hopefully have success, then go to the state, and then hopefully work it into the national. But, again, you're looking at decades to make these things happen because the two parties control the systems and more than anything, they want to keep out any other third entity.
Well, also, we have that in San Francisco in city elections, and we do have a couple of green elected officials in our board of supervisors and board as school boards. But, you know, like you said, that to change it at the federal level, it's going to take the federal government to change it. And do you foresee with, you know, the scoundrels we have in Congress now that there will ever be a time when they're going to vote to give away their power to actually people like me, maybe?
No, I don't see that. But what I do see is a groundswell a bit happening at the grassroots level that simply can become a large swell at some point and vote these people out of office. And I don't see that as being unattainable. I proved that you could win, and I won. I only raised $300,000 to become governor of Minnesota. Every person on my campaign except for one from the primary to the general election was a volunteer. And we ran a campaign on ideas rather than money. So it can work, but it's very, very difficult because
right.
The Democrats and Republicans, of course, control the game and control the rules. It's much like playing a football game, and they have the ability to change the rules at halftime.
Did you defeat an incumbent, or was it an open seat at that point?
No, it was an open seat,
okay.
As I've advocated. For third-party candidates, it's always best to have an open seat. I believe that. And no, Governor Arne Carlson had served two terms, and we don't have term limits in Minnesota, but most of our governors leave after two anyway. And he was a Republican. He chose not to seek re-election, so it was wide open. It ended up with Skip Humphrey, Hubert Humphrey's son, against Senator Norm Coleman, who at that
right.
time was the mayor of St. Paul, the Republican. And then I, of course, was the Independence Party.
Have they solved that issue yet between Norm Coleman and Al Franken?
No, they haven't. But, you know, it's the system.
Right.
And, you know, if people are upset with it, then change the system. They're simply following the system. The election was so close that law required a recount.
Right.
So they went through the systematic recount.
Mm-hmm.
Coleman had won the initial election by 120 votes or something like that. Don't quote me, but it was a very small amount.
Very small. Uh-huh.
And then in the recount, Franken was declared the winner, but it did allow Coleman to go through the judiciary process of appeals, which he is exercising, and he has every right to do so. So
right.
Unless you want to change the system, it's simply taking its course, and you certainly want, I would hope you'd want to get it right. And I think that's what they're attempting to do, and it's taking
right.
them probably longer than they expected because it was appealed all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and they've heard it now, and they should rule on it shortly, and hopefully it'll come to an end.
Well, we definitely have some profound problems in our country and, you know, around the world. And Barack Obama was elected as a change candidate. As somebody, you know, I follow politics very closely, of course. But you were on Larry King when you, you know, made a famous statement. But you also told him that if you were president, you would prosecute the people who did the torture, but not only the people who committed the torture on the ground, but those who ordered it. And can you tell us a little bit about that and why you don't think that, why you think that President Obama is not?
Well, you know, the law is the law, Cindy, and if we're going to be a country that stands by the rule of law, which we should be, even when it's inconvenient, we have to be that country. And torture is against the law. I don't care who it is, tortures against the law.
Right.
We didn't torture Charles Manson. We didn't torture Ramirez, the other killer out there.
Right.
McVeigh and Nichols, the Oklahoma City bombers, were not tortured. We are a country that should stand by the rule of law with no exception. And we must rise above it and not sink to a level that we will torture people. And I'm very adamant about that. And it angers me because the people who made the decision whether to torture or not were, as I said on Larry King, cowards. I mean, Dick Cheney had 5 deferments from the Vietnam War and wanted nothing to do with it. And yet he's going to make the decision. He and his lawyers will define what torture is. And I've been waterboarded. When I did my service in the United States Navy, I completed underwater demolition SEAL training. And after jump school, we were required, if we were going into the combat zone of Vietnam, that you had to attend SEER school and survival escape resistance evasion. And it was in that school that all of us were essentially waterboarded, and it was very clear to me that it was torture. And for them to now simply change the name and call it enhanced interrogation, I counter by saying, well, if that's the case, then when we have gangs out there, and gangs do things that hurt society. When we get the next gang member into custody, are we allowed to waterboard him to gain information? Of course not. It's against the law. And we should stand by the rule of law. Plus, and let me finish with this quickly, any information that you get torturing someone is useless. It carries no validation because when you're being tortured, you will say and do anything to stop the torture. So there's no credibility to it.
Right.
You know, if torture worked, then I would say, how come we haven't captured Bin Laden?
Well, exactly. Well, and of course, Dick Cheney, as you've pointed out, has been going all over admitting freely to formulating the policies of torture. My opponent, Nancy Pelosi, knew as early as March of 2003 that our country was committing these war crimes and crimes against humanity and also crimes against our own Constitution. And there's a case out in San Francisco now. It's a 38-year-old case where some Black Panthers were tortured and they confessed to a murder that they, of course, didn't do. But like you said, people will confess to anything if they're tortured.
Yeah, absolutely they will. That's why it has no credibility to it. And, you know, for us to advocate torture is completely wrong. You just should not do it under any circumstances. And for Dick Cheney to be out there advocating this, I think, is just horrible on his part. And for a guy who he himself would never dare put the uniform on or stand out there and subject himself to it.
Well, and, you know, also, like you said, torture should not be done under any circumstances. The people on the ground who tortured, it was wrong for them to do, and they should be held accountable. But it seems like we're turning into a country that is letting this slide. But if we let it slide, and I'm so glad you're going on places like Larry King to talk about it, because if we let torture slide, it's not only says something bad about our leaders and the people on the ground who are doing it, but says something bad about we Americans who are not standing up to say our country does not do this.
Well, we hold ourselves up to the world, but see, they're using a great ploy, and that's public safety. If you scare the public and then the government tells you now this is what we have to do to protect you, many people will get taken over by that frame of thought. I mean, 50% of Americans think that what he did was okay because it was saving lives they were pumping into their heads.
Well, Governor,
and, you know, that's a constant thing government will try to do to get the populace behind them. And what people need to understand, Cindy, is that I like to say the, quote, dissension is the greatest form of patriotism because it is. If you don't hold elected people's feet to the fire, you will get bad government. So when they tell you not to dissent or not to speak out against your government, that's the wrong thing to do. You're not being a patriot if you go meek and mildly and do not speak out for what the Constitution stands for and what our country stands for. And torture is not one of those things, and we need to stop it immediately and prosecute them. You know, when that's where I'm angry, because President Obama, the reason they're not doing it is because, as you said, the Democrats are likewise involved.
Exactly.
Whenever the government tells you it's time to move on, it's because both parties are guilty. Now, the Democrats didn't order the torture, but as you said, they knew it was going on and they did nothing to stop it.
Well, I'm sure they knew, they were briefed fully, so if a situation like this came up, then they would have their butts covered. So we just have a couple minutes left, and you said that you would, if you had Dick Cheney for a few minutes and a water board, you could get him to confess to anything. But as somebody who was waterboarded in your training, you said that you know that when you're being waterboarded, it's just going to stop. But how would you think people who we capture illegally and detain illegally or waterboarded, what are they feeling when that's happening to them?
Well, you know, waterboarding is so bad that even if you know it's going to stop, it's still just as bad. I mean, Mancow, the radio personality from Chicago, he had me back on his show because he apologized to me. He was one of those people that felt that you couldn't die from it. It should be used. It saves lives. Well, he submitted himself to it, and he lasted 6 seconds. Because what people don't realize, when the water rushes into your nose, it goes straight into your sinus cavities. And anybody that's had water go into their sinus cavities knows how painful that is.
Well, it's not simulated drowning. It is drowning.
Well, it can be. It certainly can be if it's done wrong. That's why at SEER school there's always a doctor present. So, you know, and like he asked me if I would do it to him, and I declined. I said, I'm not trained in that. I received it, but I certainly would not tell you that I received any training in applying it. You'd need to get one of the SEER school instructors to do it, because they're the ones trained at doing it.
Well, Governor, we're unfortunately out of time. It's been so wonderful to talk to you. What are you doing right now? What are your plans? Are you going to...
Well, I come back to the States and spend the summers. Now I'm kind of semi-retired, and I'm writing another book, which I enjoy doing, and I do a lot of reading in Mexico. I'm also attempting, and I know it's kind of self-serving, but I'm at a point in my life of my latter 50s where I'm attempting to become the best surfer I can be. I've boogie boarded and body surfed, and now I'm trying to board surf, and it's real dedication, and it's very difficult, especially at my age, so I have to be totally focused on it, and and surfing truly is a lifestyle.
And I actually had heard about that and read about that. Well, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan so far.
Well, thank you, Cindy, and you keep up the good work. Cindy, if I could just say this to you, had I been the President of the United States, I would have met with you.
I know.
You know, because to me, it why not? And
if you stand
for what you believe in, you won't be afraid to meet anybody on it.
Well, right. Well, like you said, but we have to stand up for what's right, no matter what it costs us. And I appreciate your service, and thanks for being on the show. And hopefully
thank you, and keep up the good work, and keep talking, because remember, dissension's the greatest form of patriotism.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Cindy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was our guest, Governor Jesse Ventura. This is Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and Rational Radio, 1360 AM in Dallas. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with my next guest, Derek Jensen.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehanSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehanSoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and Rational Radio 1360 in Dallas. My next guest is writer and activist Derek Jensen. Derek, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Hey, thank you for having me on the show.
Well, you're very a hard person to pin down. I've been reading a lot about you and a lot of the things that you write. And the thing that jumps out at me, of course, is your environmental work. How would you, like, pin yourself down? I don't really want you to, nail yourself down, because I hate to do that myself. But just, like, give us a brief sketch of you.
Well, yeah, I have the same sort of difficulty with pinning myself down in terms of, am I a writer? Am I an activist? Am I an anarchist? Am I an environmentalist? And basically where I come down on all of that is that I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that's not being murdered. And if that makes me an environmentalist, then great. And, and partly I've been thinking about this because I just learned that there are some feminists who say that men should not call themselves feminists because that's a term reserved for women, and so men are supposed to call themselves pro-feminists. And I don't really it's sort of the same thing on that I don't care what you call me as long as men stop beating on and raping women. And we can say the same thing.
Right.
Are you an anti-war activist? Well, you want war to stop. And I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's like, no, you're actually a human being.
Right. That's what I call myself, a humanist, because it's super hard because we have political designations, religious designations, all kinds of different designations, that none of them make sense to me. I heard someone call you an anarcho-syndicalist. Does that make sense?
Well, that one I know I'm not.
Uh-huh. I know, because it didn't make sense to me when she said that, because isn't that people, it's more labor-oriented?
Yeah, and I've certainly done some work on labor issues, but
right.
If somebody puts me in an anarcho camp, they usually put me in the anarcho-primitivist.
And okay.
What that means is that I see civilization, this whole big culture that we have around us, as being inherently unsustainable.
Right.
And it's been unsustainable. There's a great line by this anthropologist, Stanley Diamond. Civilization originates in conquest abroad and repression at home. And,
right.
The culture is inherently, it's based on military conquest, and it's also based on environmental conquest. I mean, right now, as we speak, there are huge battles going on all around the world. I mean, not only the big military ones that we hear about all the time, but there are huge fights going on in South America where indigenous peoples are attempting to stop the expropriation of their land in the Amazon. And then
in
also
Peru, and hundreds of them were murdered last week.
Yeah, yeah. And in Nigeria, the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta has been fighting back against a military offensive that's been going on the last couple of weeks. So there's those levels. So once again, if I'm going to have to put a label, it would be, I'd fall in there. But then, it seems like we're both pretty squishy about the whole label thing.
I definitely am. Do you know anything about the farm in Summertown, Tennessee?
No. When you said the farm, the first thing I thought of is the big fight a couple years ago down in L.A.
Right.
But no, I don't know. Tell me about that.
Well, it's just it was just a bunch of hippies, essentially from California, that moved here in 1971 and bought 1,000 acres and had a collective, and now they've purchased 750 more acres, and what they do is that they try to live as close to primitive nature as possible. It used to be in a collective. Now they have individual homes, and it's still a community.
Mm-hmm.
So it just it's really cool, and something that I think, I wish I lived on right now, because I'm very troubled about, you know, the future of our economy, the future of our ecology, our environment. And, you know, we could see, you know, imminently the collapse of the dollar. And then what's going to happen to, you know, people who aren't like you, primitivists, or people who live on the farm? You know, most of us are concentrated in cities or suburbs with no cooperation, you know, no cooperatives. We barely even know our neighbors. And so, you know, it's just very troubling that something could happen so soon that would, you know, essentially be very disastrous for most of the people living, not just in America, but the world.
Well, I think sometimes that if there was somebody looking at this culture from some sort of outside perspective, I think that it would be pretty easy to come to the conclusion that those in power are doing everything they can to make the crash, the ecological crash, as bad as possible. And I'm not saying that in a sort of conspiracy theory sort of way at all. I'm just saying that the actions, if you have an entire economy that is based on the use of non-renewable resources,
right,
for example, oil,
right,
you would think you would make some plans for what you're going to do as that oil runs out and make some sort of a transition away from it, as opposed to you know, simply invading other countries and attempting to, you know, get every last drop as quickly as you can. And likewise, you know, when you think about all the solutions, so-called solutions that are put forward, for example, the global warming, they all have the same thing in common, which is that they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is then made into something which must conform to industrial capitalism,
uh-huh,
as opposed to the other way around.
Right.
It's like I was doing this interview a couple years ago. It was terrible. It was this radio interview out of Santa Barbara, and the guy was this right-wing, anti-environmental, property rights, uber, all his Bible thumper. And he basically just wanted me on his show so he could yell at me.
See, that's why I never go on those shows.
Well, I'm not going. I didn't know what – it was kind of an ambush. I had no idea going on the show what was going to happen.
Right.
And so I was saying, you know, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. There's 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton in the ocean, which is the equivalent of, out of every 10 bites you eat, 9 of them would be styrofoam. I mean, I was just going through all this litany of things that are happening. And he kept saying the same thing back to me, which is, that's all fine, Derek, but let's get back in the real world. You know, I'm talking about docks and every mother's breast milk, all this stuff. And I kept thinking, I thought I was talking about the real world until – what I realize is that for him, the real world is industrial capitalism. It's kind of like when you're in college, or when somebody's in college, you know, somebody will say, "So what are you going to do when you get out in the real world?"
Right.
And what they mean is, what are you going to do when you have to get a job?
Right.
But that's not the real world. And so part of the problem, one of the things I try to do in my work, is to help us remember that there is a real world, and that that any social structure you have is dependent upon a real physical world. And without a real physical world, you don't have any social structure. So approaches to global warming or approaches to any environmental problems should take the real physical world as primary. And any ideologies or any social structures at all have to be secondary to that, and have to conform to the natural world. So instead of asking, you know, basically, how much can we trash the planet before it will affect profits?
Right.
I would ask the question, what does the land give willingly, and how can we live such that we're not trashing the place? You know, I live in way northern California, and the Talua Indians lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. If you believe the myths of Talua, lived just since the beginning of time. So at least 12,500 years. And when this culture got here about 180 years ago, the place was paradise. You know, salmon so thick that you couldn't see the bottom of the stream, and now the place is absolutely trashed. And,
well,
you know, we can repeat
like
the story everywhere.
I'm sorry, you say like industrial capitalism It's that I was talking to somebody yesterday at this peace fair I was at in Nashville, and he said that, you know, they want to have some kind of, you know, they want to, like, develop an idea of responsible capitalism. Do you think that that's even possible?
No. For a couple reasons. One of them, I mean, sure, it can be less irresponsible than it is right now.
Right.
But the economy is fundamentally based on extraction. And if you... The only way to live sustainably in place is to not take more than what the land gives willingly. And so if you have a way of life that's based at all on non-renewable resources, it won't last. It's pretty obvious. If you have a finite amount of any material, if you use it, you're eventually going to use it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same as true with the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources, whereby if every year there are fewer salmon returned than there were the year before, eventually there won't be any, as we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And so capitalism is based fundamentally on the notion of taking whatever you can. And see, there's a deeper problem here, too, which is how we perceive the world. And there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, which is what capitalism teaches us to do, you're going to treat them one way.
Mm-hmm.
And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. And this is true whether we're talking about trees, fish, women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way.
Right.
If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And so capitalism is fundamentally based on the notion of converting all of these others into cash. And it's based on converting workers, human beings, into workers as well. It's how can you take their excess, too. So
right.
I think that you can have a capitalism that's less psychopathological than the current one. But I think... And I don't believe in the revolution versus reform dichotomy. I think if somebody wants to do reform work, I think that's wonderful and great because we need all the help we can get. That's one of the great things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's really
mm-hmm.
great work to be done.
Right.
But ultimately, it's going to have to go a lot beyond that.
Well, I told, you know, that's what I told this man, and I said that, of course, capitalism is all about immediate profit over any kind of future sustainability, which that's why I don't think it can be, I don't think capitalism can be reformed. But the reason I got aware of you was an article you wrote for Orion Magazine called Beyond Hope. And, you know, it brilliantly put into words what, you know, the Obama mania, and I don't even think you might mention Obama in this.
Oh, no, I don't, because
no,
it was written
don't.
3 or 4
you
years ago.
No, you don't. You say Democrat. But you know, it kind of put what I'm feeling. It's like, oh, if we have hope, you know, if there's some, you know, great hope of ours in the White House, and then we can just relax and we don't have to worry about anything. We don't have to be activists anymore. We can just, like, pack up and go home and let this hope, you know, just put us back to sleep. And no matter, contrary to any of the actions or the policies or the results, we can still, you know, be comforted with this emotion of hope. And I actually call it the four-letter H word.
Huh.
But tell my listeners about your... let me say one thing that you said about hope that just struck me was that in your article you say, frankly, I don't have much hope. But I think that's a good thing. Hope is what keeps us chained to the system. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. There's two levels at which I think hope is really, at least two levels at which I think hope is really harmful. The first is that years and years and years ago, a friend sent me a bunch of literature about HIV, and which doesn't really matter, but the point is that there was one sentence in one of the articles he sent that just blew me away, which is, eliminate false hope. And I love that because false hopes bind us to unlivable situations. My father is extremely abusive, and one of the reasons my mother stayed with my father for as long as she did is because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s, but another reason she stayed with him is because of the false hope that he would change.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have these false hopes. You know, if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, well, then things will be okay. You know, if we can just get Democrats to control Congress, then things will be okay. You know, those are all false hopes when we really think about them. I mean, does anybody really think that the U.S. military is going to stop invading all sorts of other countries because we asked them nicely to?
Right.
You know, does anybody really think? There's all these false hopes we have. So that's fine. And I was bashing false hopes at this talk I did years ago, and someone in the audience shouted out, what is your definition of hope? I thought, gosh, I don't know. You know, I've been bashing hope for years. I have no idea what I'm talking about. And then I asked the audience, what's your definition? And they came up with a great definition, which is, hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency.
Right.
And so if I say, I hope that salmon survive, or I hope something else, what I'm saying is that I have no agency.
Right.
And so think about this in terms of, you know, like, if when I was 10 years old, if my mom would have said to me, clean your room, and I would have said, I hope it gets done, you know, it would have been a total non-starter. I was talking to a bunch of ninth graders, oh, maybe a month ago, and I asked them, the class, what would your parents say if they said, please clean your room, and you said, I hope it gets done? And the ninth graders all got it. You know,
yeah.
Hope is a non-starter. Hope is when you have no agency. And so I'm not really interested in hope that way. But having said that, I also need to say, just to clarify, I'm just trying to be really precise, that a friend of mine whose brother was dying of cancer said to me when I was bashing some hope, she said, so are you saying that I can't hope my brother survives? I said, no, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is you can't stand there with car keys in your hand as your brother needs to go to the hospital and say, I hope you make it to the hospital. So what I'm really interested in is figuring out what it's like. This Anishinaabeg Indian woman wrote to me and said, you know, I love what you say about hope, but where does prayer fit in? I mean, we can't just hope salmon survive. We need to take out the dams.
Mm-hmm.
But once the dams are gone, at that point, we need to. She didn't use the word hope. She used the word prayer. Once we've done what our part, then we have to pray that the salmon accept that offering and they return. And I totally agree that we can't just hope, you know, light some candles. I mean, candles are fine, but we can't just light candles and hope that the U.S. war machine stops doing what the U.S. war machine does. We have to act, and then at some point, you know, we have to do everything we can, and then we have to do more. And then beyond that, we have to recognize that there are some things beyond our control.
Well, right, but
and that's where hope comes in. But hope is a non-starter. It's like you say, it's a four-letter word because people use it to keep from doing anything.
Well, exactly, and it does keep us chained to the system because, you know, we actually have agency when it comes to our government, or we're supposed to, you know. So we either have a negative, you know, hope, or just the apathy that. So either we're hoping that Obama changes things, or we're just apathetically cynical, so we don't get off of our own butts to try and change things.
Well, and I think, and I totally agree with you, and I think there are, of course, other options, which is to begin to recognize that it's not our government, that it's the government of, by, and for the rich, and of, by, and for the capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
And then to start to It's like a lot of American Indian friends say to me, it's the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. It's like a doctor friend of mine says that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis.
Uh-huh.
So as soon as we start to see that all this talk of hope by Obama is pretty meaningless, that he's just, I mean, he represents capital.
Uh-huh.
And it's insanity to think that he doesn't represent capital. There was this thing Nader said back in, I think, 96, in which he said, if I'm elected, I won't be able to do anything about bringing into place socialized health care, you know, universal health care, because the corporations won't let me.
Uh-huh.
And his point is the point that I took from that is that there are some really serious functional problems. And I actually find, and it's so interesting because my sister is fairly right wing, but she's great because she's one of those. She's not like a neocon. She's
mm-hmm.
like honest to goodness, local control type of conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's actually a lot of places where we come together.
Right,
and
exactly.
One of them is that we both think that Obama makes a much better and more effective, I guess is the word, a much more effective figurehead for those in power than Bush did, because Obama's personable and he smiles.
Right.
And both of us actually find Obama far more scary in some ways than we do Bush.
I'm with you, definitely with you on that. We have, a little about like 5 more minutes left. And one of the lines that you say, first of all, let's talk about, forget about that. Let's talk about the environment. Let's talk about, Obama has been in office now for, what, today, like 5 months. And where do you see, you were talking about sustainability and that we're going to drain this planet. We're going to wring this planet out of every drop of oil. And then maybe when it runs out, then they'll say, oh, we need to investigate alternative forms or sustainable forms. What grade do you give the Obama administration so far on this?
It's tough because he has, I guess I give him a D because
mm-hmm.
on the environment, I don't think it would have been possible for George Bush to have been any worse.
Right.
He was at every step, he was just appallingly awful. And Obama has been an extreme disappointment. Mountaintop removal is actually a really good example of that.
Right.
Tell
my listeners about the mountaintop removal.
Well, mountaintop removal is where you cut the entire top of a mountain off to get at the coal and then dump the mine waste into streams and fill up valleys. And it's leveling mountains all through the southeast, West Virginia,
right.
And the point is that
Obama calls clean coal. And, tell my listeners about his Environmental Protection Agency. Boy, that's an Orwellian term if there ever was one, about the leases that they recently gave out for this.
Are you talking about the mountaintop removal?
Yes.
Yeah, that I think there was, okay, I'm making up the numbers. You might know them better than I. Was it 120 leases or so? There was a lot that, anyway, the point is that the EPA went ahead and approved most of them. I think there were, I'm making up the numbers, but it's like 20% is all they turned down.
And the more than even happened during the Bush administration.
Yeah. Yeah, so he's got, I mean, that's the thing with Obama, is, and that's why I find him more scary, is that his rhetoric is infinitely better, but the reality is, as I said a couple times, he's still serving capital.
He's doing what he said during his campaign. He talked glowingly about clean coal, which Robert Kennedy Jr. calls a dirty lie. He talked glowingly about nuclear power. So he said these things. And I don't get to watch TV that much. I imagine you don't either. But once in a while, I'll see a commercial for clean coal when it's Obama giving one of his, very inspirational speeches about how we can become energy, you know, become independent from foreign energy if we could just, like, you know, do more with clean coal. To
well,
me, that's abominable.
Well, it's abominable on a bunch of levels, and one of them is that, you know, global warming is a hugely serious threat, and coal is a disaster. Another part is that coal can never replace oil for many of the uses
right.
of oil. So even on a, you know, sort of capitalist fantasy level, it doesn't hold. I mean, oil is a unique commodity that way. And so even from the perspective of the capitalist, he's not telling the truth there.
And then, of course, then his the people who trust him and have hope in him, you know, they don't think critically anymore. It's almost like, well, it is like the people who had hope and trusted George Bush. There was, like, absolutely no critical thinking going on. We just have a couple minutes left, Derek. Tell my I want to ask you one final question, but tell my listeners where they can find more of your writings and more about you.
Well, I've got a website, which is derrickjensen.org, DerrickJensen.org.
Definitely recommend to read this article, Beyond Hope. And people often tell me, Cindy, oh my gosh, you know, how can you live without hope? You know, you don't have hope in Obama, so you must not have hope in anything. But you say in your article, and I want you to talk about it for the last couple minutes we have, you say a wonderful thing happens when you give up on hope, which is that you realize you never needed it in the first place. Please tell my listeners about this and give them some, you know, encouragement to really rise up and to make change ourselves and not hope in a system that, like you said, relies and extracts capital.
Well, it's like I said earlier, that if you were a child and your parents said to you, clean your room, and you said, I hope it gets done, that's a total non-starter, and there's no reason for it to be not a non-starter now. And we have to realize that we are not powerless, that there are many things we can do on a local level, on a larger scale level. The thing is, it's a lot of work, and we just need to get started doing it. And I want to say something in terms of encouragement. One of the smartest things that the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Do you want to get an ID card, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed?
Right.
Do you want to move to a ghetto? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to get a cattle car? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist.
Right.
But even under those conditions, there were those who resisted. And something very, very important is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. We should never, never forget that. That those who actually fought back had a higher rate of survival than those who didn't.
Well, thank you, Derek, for being on my show, and I hope, you know, we can chat again about, because very fascinating, everything on your website. I could spend hours there. I encourage people to go to Derek's website and to Google his article, Beyond Hope. It was in Orion Magazine. It's just something that was very inspirational and really meant a lot to me. So, Derek, thank you for being on my show, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your work. I'd love to chat with you again.
Okay, Derek. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at cindysheehansoapbox.com and in Dallas on 1360 AM Rational Radio. When we come back, we'll be listening to an interview that I did with Alex Jones last week in Austin, Texas. No matter what you think about Alex Jones, I happen to like him and agree with him many things, not everything he does or says, but on many things Alex and I agree. He interviewed me for an hour last week. We're going to play a short 10-minute segment of that, and I was able to really talk about what I'm doing right now, my ideology, the direction I'm going with Myth America. So when we come back from this short break, you'll be hearing the interview I did with Alex Jones. And stay tuned after that, and we'll say a quick goodbye. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Well, and that's the whole premise of my book, is that not to challenge the system in a full frontal attack. It's to very subversively undermine the system by removing ourselves from it, to create voluntary cooperatives where we share and grow food together, share resources together, remove ourselves from the banking system, remove ourselves from the credit system, remove ourselves from the military-industrial.
We've got to do it quick because...
That's why I published it online. Mm-hmm. That's why I didn't go through a publisher, so it can get into as many people's hands as possible, and to create communities in cooperation with each other to remove ourselves from their systems. And it won't matter.
And they will be assaulted. The outside enemy will find excuses to get in. That's why they assault anything that tries to, humans get their backs together and try to defend themselves like cows do when wolves come. Mm-hmm. Cows will get in a circle.
Right.
And, try to protect the calves.
That's why they're trying to keep us divided, so we can't get together and figure out what they're doing to us. And like you said, it's divide and conquer. It's what we've been doing throughout history in occupations. It's what we're currently doing in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan. Do you think Pakistan is an existential threat to the United States? No. What they're doing is further destabilizing that government.
I agree. Stay there. Globalist-controlled forces on record are there trying to destabilize Pakistan. Cindy Sheehan with us for another 22 minutes or so. I want to go to Saeed, Ian, Aaron, Jonathan, Morgan, and many others here in just a moment. Cindy, you got cut off a couple breaks ago, and you were about to get to a story dealing with the whole left-right paradigm and how they were trying to buy you off and how the Democrats, wanted you to just go quietly into the night, and we hit that break. I mean, that is such an important point here, that we've gone from these self-righteous Democrats are going to end this war,
right.
And now Rahm Emanuel and his brother, he's now calling the big Hollywood mogul in the news today, arrogantly brags, oh, look at how I suckered the Democrats and how they really kept anti-war Democrats from winning.
Oh, absolutely. Rahm Emanuel, one case in point is Christine Sigalas in Illinois. She ran against Henry Hyde as a Democrat in 2004 and almost won. She wanted to run again, but she was absolutely anti-war. So Rahm flew in Tammy Duckworth, a disabled Iraq veteran, to run against her, beat Sigalas in the primaries, but she was beaten by the Republicans. So, and then the DCCC dumped a lot of money into Tammy Duckworth's campaign to beat Christine Sigalas, who would have been an anti-war Democrat. So the Democrats used and betrayed the anti-war movement to get in power. And Democrats told me to my face, Alex, many of them on Capitol Hill, if you get us in power, if you help get us in power, Cindy, because they knew the energy of my movement was powerful. They knew that their base was anti-war. Their base wasn't just anti-Bush. Their base was anti-war. So they abused the energy of the anti-war movement, betrayed it, got into power, and did nothing. And then after they were empowering 2007, you know what those same people told me? Help us elect more Democrats, Cindy. And that's when I said, oh, this is just bull crap. They're never going to be happy unless it's 100% democratically controlled, which I think is tyranny. I think that
even if the two parties are almost completely controlled, only having a one party, then you really are in trouble.
I think that the more parties, the more healthy our democracy would be. Our democracy is sick. Our democracy is on life support right now because of the corporate control of both of the parties. Barack Obama and John McCain, they got money from the same people. So whoever won the election in 2008, 1968, the robber class would win and we would lose. No matter who won, we lost. Even if you voted for the candidate that won, I hate to tell you this, but you lost.
Cindy Sheehan, what do you see happening to our republic in the future?
You know, we're going to go through some very tough economic times, unfortunately. I don't think it's going to get any better until it gets a lot worse. And if it does get better, then what is our country going to look like? Is it going to be looking like 1984, a brave new world? Or is it going to look like a country that is broken up into smaller pieces, which I think would be better, would be more manageable? Is that going to happen with violence? Is it going to happen peacefully? You know, I really don't know, but That's why I'm out on tour, Alex. I have three surviving children, one grandchild, he's 1 year old, and one on the way, and I could take my kids, and I could practice what I know. You know, we could start our own little community that's self-sustaining, you know, off the grid and things like that. But I want to go around the country, and I want to encourage people to work together to thrive through the coming collapse of the empire. I'm glad the empire is collapsing.
It's collapsing because the people running it are so greedy.
Right.
They're eating themselves.
Right.
They're destroying the goose that laid all these eggs because their nature is just hyper corrupt.
We could voluntarily give it up as the robber class could voluntarily give up the empire, but that's not going to happen. Like you said, they're so greedy. They're so greedy, they don't care what's going to happen with their children and grandchildren. I care about their children and grandchildren as well as I care about my children and grandchildren. So we have to create these communities to be able to survive.
I want to go to calls, but briefly, tell me more about your idea, because I think true diversity. I'm not against the Free State Project, but everybody going to one state, you know, that's a decent idea because I guess they can try to take the state back over and, you know, have kind of a libertarian idea. That's wonderful. But I think it's better just to have lots of true diverse ideas, lots of communities everywhere to be examples to others.
Right.
And all sorts of true diversity, true liberty, you know, out there. And, you know, to defeat the globalists, they can always go after one state or one group or one idea or one leader.
Right.
But if we have the opposite of the cookie cutter, all of this, the words diversity again, going in different angles and directions, there's no way for them to compute, no way for them to counter, no way for them to demonize, no way for them to set up.
Mm-hmm.
And if good people will just stop looking for leaders, even Cindy Sheehan or Alex Jones or Ron Paul, but look to themselves to start something now. Just do it, as they say. Start taking action in some way. Doesn't mean you have all the answers. Doesn't mean you're perfect. Doesn't mean you're going to do it all right.
Right.
But at least you're standing up.
And doing something. And that's my whole premise, is that it's not as effective for one person or a couple people to do a lot. It's more effective for everybody to do something. And then working together, community-based. And you know, as well as I, that in the summer of 2005, you know, not only was our movement co-opted, but I was also set up. Right? I was set up because they saw when I was going to start retaining my integrity and speaking out against the policies and the principles instead of just George Bush, that they had to, you know what the favorite slur from the so-called left is to me? I'm too radical. So they don't have to listen to me because I'm an extremist. So they tried to make me look crazy. They tried to make me look, you know, mentally unstable because of my son's death, you know, irrational. And that was as much the left as it was the right, because the media is just part of the robber class. And like I said, there's no left, right, or Democratic, Republican paradigm. Look at the media is giving Obama practically a free pass. They haven't covered me and my opposition to Obama, but when I went down to Dallas the other day, we were everywhere in the news about our protests against George Bush. Why is that?
Because they want to make it a left-right issue. They want to have it the liberal Sheehan is against Bush to remind folks it's the bad Bush.
Right.
They don't want to show you going up against Obama and shattering that left-right paradigm. Yeah, tell folks briefly what happened with Bush.
when we were down there?
Yeah, in Dallas.
Well, we had about 100 people just marched for accountability, and we had about 12 pro-Bush people on the other side of the street. I thought that was very interesting because it was in his neighborhood, and only 12 of his neighbors came out. But we got a lot of press coverage from that, and it was good press coverage because they said accountability. They said Cindy Sheehan and the people with her want a special prosecutor. They actually did cover what we were saying instead of, you know, the style, they were covering the substance, which I was very surprised about, especially being in Dallas.
Well, I mean, that is a positive thing, and I think that's because a lot of the media internally are upset. A lot of them are moral. They're just told what to say and what to do. And more as they say no, and more as they do little things to get the truth out, I think that's what's going to bring them down.
Well, and I do want to, did I say it on the air? Did I tell you when we were off the air that my radio show is going to be on in Dallas?
Yeah, you were telling me. It's Sundays, and give us the website for your...
The radio show's in Dallas Sunday at 3 on Rational Radio. That's AM 1360. And then my show can also be heard on the internet at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. And people can order a copy of my book, Myth America, from CindySheehanSoapbox.com. It's just for a minimum $10 donation. I got several orders last night after I was on Jason's show, so I appreciate it.
Oh, good. People need to support you, folks, and that's what this is about. If you want to see Cindy able to keep going around the country pointing out the hypocrisy of Obama and the Republicans, then go to the website and get this great ebook and show it to your friends and family, and also tell folks about our radio show. Again, plug the website again.
CindySheehanSoapbox.com.
Thanks for listening to that interview I did with Alex Jones last week. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for listening again to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'd like to thank my guests, Governor Jesse Ventura, Derek Jensen. I'd like, as always, to thank my engineer, Scott Petty, and my webmaster, Rich Bowser. And if you're new to the show, stay tuned. We do this great close that we just hope inspires people to do what Derek said and to work for a true change. We got it off of YouTube. We hope you enjoy it, and we'll catch you next week.
I just make my witness. I have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the streets. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. Thank you.
get up now. I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Just get up from your chairs right now. Go stick your head out and yell and keep yelling, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. Just get up from your chairs.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.